You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Courtney Coulson. This is Minute 33. This minute opens with Holloway saying, "Fifold, you gotta read," and ends with Holloway saying, "Don't be a skeptic." So, this time, the rare occasion, I am in fact joined by a guest, my friend Dean.
Greetings.
We met at uni a million years ago, it feels like now. You are not a podcaster, generally speaking.
Not by trade, no. Not as yet. One day.
A large part of our friendship is having long philosophical discussions, particularly about AI, pretending we're Sam Harris.
Basically everything on the Sam Harris podcast, but less thorough.
Yes, yeah. And louder.
Yeah, exactly.
I brought you on to this minute because we are, in fact, discussing AI, not androids, though, but these little creatures called pups, if you will, which they are very much anthropomorphized. I'm even calling them creatures because that's...
Because they're adorable, Courtney.
They're marketable, they're toyetic, if you will.
And all it took was the name pups.
Yeah. Yep. The human psyche is so malleable.
I love them now.
In this particular minute, Firefield's leading the troop, saying that the pups are telling him to go this way. I hadn't given it much thought before, but what is he talking about? In the previous minute, he says, if there's anything here worth looking at, these pups will find them. What exactly are the pups looking for? They eventually lead the crew to the door leading to the ampule room. So I guess they did find something out of the ordinary. That's quite a vague command to give an AI. What defines interesting or unusual in an alien world? What sort of features would it prioritize? They seem to use lasers to scan the environment to make a 3D map of it. So this is known as LiDAR technology, which is kind of like radar, but with lasers. Given that the pups emit a range of sounds, I kind of think there might be some kind of radar at play as well. There is nothing to indicate that they can sense anything on the other side of that door leading to the ampule room. The other thing is the engineer corpses in front of the door are quite mummified, so would the pups even see them as once living creatures? Or would they simply read as yet more stone? Basically, the technology behind the pups must be quite sophisticated, able to not only gather data but interpret it in a sophisticated way. And given that this is a world with lifelike androids, it is no surprise, but I think it's interesting to consider nonetheless.
Well, as you've mentioned, it is interesting to note that this is an advanced universe, technologically, where we have lifelike androids. So that kind of gives us the ability to skip over otherwise very important questions, which is how these things actually get up and fly around. How they navigate.
Well, like in Star Wars, how they you have hover technology. Who knows? It's repulsing from the ground.
Yeah, so I'm willing to accept all of that. But as for the image recognition ability that we're talking about, the sort of ability to find something worth looking at, we have a couple of real-world examples at this point, which is kind of fascinating. The thing that comes to mind, of course, is what's known as the Google Vision API, or... people will probably know it as Google Lens if they own a phone that has that installed. And essentially, one of the more accessible ways to find this effect in action is if you go to something like Google Photos and you put a photo in, and it will tell you what kind of dog is in the photo. So this is image recognition working at its current capability. So
yeah, that's happened to me because I went through the photos in my phone, which is a Pixel. And yeah, it could tell my dog was not, like, it didn't just go, oh, it's a dog. It said, it's probably a cross between a West Highland Terrier and a Maltese Shih Tzu, which is crazy, because a human being would generally not be able to look at a dog and go, oh, yeah, that's clearly a mix of these two breeds. That's crazy.
It is, and it's achieved by machine learning, so essentially showing a machine thousands upon thousands of pictures of a West Highland Terrier and a Shih Tzu?
Maltese Shih Tzu.
Maltese Shih Tzu. And then crossbreeds. And over millions and millions of images, the machine will start to learn which is which. And I imagine in the case of the pups, so it's got this image recognition technology, let's say, it's collecting data from all around it. Like you say, LiDAR is definitely working, we can see.
Yeah.
Presumably it also has cameras. In order to image its surroundings, because one would think that a 3D map generated by LiDAR wouldn't... It could give you geological information. It could find a unique geological structure, such as the hole in the room.
Yeah, so it's just the terrain that LiDAR would be picking up on.
Mm. But if it had cameras, it could actually differentiate, you know, say something, there was something in the room that was bright green.
Mm.
That would be a unique feature.
Yeah, that's the thing that interests me the most, is how does it determine what's interesting, and how do you, is there some kind of advanced program, or you have to do, you know, in advance programming to go, this is the kind of mission we're on, these are the sort of things we want you to look for.
I actually was thinking about this after you mentioned that you might want me to talk about this on the podcast, and I think it's as simple as a whitelist or a blacklist. So you fire up one of the pups and it starts ingesting information about its surroundings. So the first thing it ingests, let's assume it uses that as a baseline and says, this is normal for mm-hmm. this environment. This is the first thing I have clapped eyes upon as an AI. That's my baseline. So everything else it finds that is similar to that, it could simply blacklist and say, that's not an interesting result because it's just like the first thing I saw.
Huh.
And then as it's traversing the terrain, if it sees anything that, whatever parameter, if it's a LiDAR, detects a giant stag. What are they called, the things that hang from the ceiling?
Stalactites.
Stalactites, yeah, yes. That one. So that would be an interesting geological feature, which it could then go, this doesn't match my blacklist of little pebbles and things that yeah. I first saw in my first second of operation. And it could define that as an interesting feature.
Hmm.
It could be as simple as that, really.
Yeah, I think that could actually potentially work. It's funny that when you are watching a movie and, like, a normal person watching it just all the way through and not 1 minute at a time, you don't think about it, but when I watched that previous minute, I just thought, okay, well, hang on, let's just break down the logistics of that, and is there anything in the real world that is similar? Which, yeah, it turns out kind of is.
Well, that's the funny thing about all this technology in films. I mean, add a couple of rotors to that thing to make it a quadricopter, and we pretty much have them. It's more the ability for just a ball floating in the air to traverse the environment that is actually the futuristic component of the pup.
Yeah, I guess it's the hardware aspect rather than the software aspect. Like, I guess software is a lot easier to work on in terms of there's no physics. You're not working with physics to an extent, I guess, unless it's like quantum computing, but other than that.
And I feel like, as you say, when it comes to hardware, you basically require some new discovery about physics in order to revolutionize hardware.
Mm.
Whereas software is incremental, and we can accept that in the future alien universe, the situation the crew in Prometheus find themselves in, it's just incremental improvements on the software we have. So we can assume that it's like something we have today, just infinitely more advanced.
It takes place in the 2090s. Yeah, I do think it's feasible. There have been all sorts of, you've probably seen this, you know, experiments in making some kind of anti-gravity systems. Magnets seem to be the popular one, but then yeah. You need some kind of track. We don't really see it anywhere else in the alien universe. Everything else is very much vehicles we recognize, ships and all of that. So, again, they are an unusual feature and an already unusual feature.
Yeah, I mean, based on my understanding of the current sort of physics, they would have to be made of a superconductor and then cooled to a very low temperature and then be put in a magnetic environment. And then it works fine.
Yeah.
But that doesn't appear to be happening.
I wouldn't be surprised if Weyland just realized, oh, these pyramids, they're actually magnetic on the inside. Perfect. I've had this prototype for years that I wanted to use. Can only work in one very specific situation.
Yeah, I just had some of these kicking around.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it past him. I didn't do my Weyland voice. Damn it. I missed my opportunity. Oh, no, my phone just recognized my voice. Oh, robots these days, getting up in our business.
Voice recognition and image recognition in the same episode.
Wowee. So, yeah, we looked up the article on the alien wikia for the pups, which they're called spectrographs. And they will say, oh, yes, they were manufactured by the Weyland Corporation. Citation needed, guys. And that's pretty much all we have on them. I'm just fascinated with them because they seem so simple. But the more you take them apart, metaphorically, I think they're such a strange little device.
It's almost as if, it is funny how they appear in the film for such a brief span of time.
Mm.
it's almost as if we weren't meant to think about them too hard and just accept them as a little sciencey MacGuffin
that's
meant to impress us.
Nah. Ridley Scott was like, some autistic boy 5 years from now is going to be scrutinizing every minute of this, so I may as well make sure that it all makes sense and he can decipher the truth. That's my theory, that there is a truth hidden in here somewhere.
You're right. Well, what's happening clearly is that Ridley Scott is a better theoretical physicist than we are.
Yes.
And he has worked out the solution and just not told anybody.
Yeah, well, he's like 100 years old. You know, he's had a lot of time to work on this stuff.
I'm happy with that as a solution. I can accept that.
Yep, all right. Pup's done. Moving on. So the next scene we see is one of the pups descending into the sinkhole, and it is a beautiful set, but I think there's something slightly perverse about it. Yeah, there's all these little streams of water trickling into the center of the hole, and for me, those grooves make the area resembles a sphincter.
A little.
Yeah. I guess it wouldn't be alien if there wasn't some kind of gross, weird biological imagery.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you actually bring that up, because I had just accepted it. Just looking at a room with a giant sinkhole shaped kind of like a sphincter at the bottom of it, I just went, yep, welcome to Alien.
Yeah.
I've come to take that as normal at this point.
My life before Alien was probably, you know, not noticing the phallic imagery, and then you first get into it, and then you notice it everywhere, and then you get to a certain point where you just go, yep, everything's got a penis or a butthole, and
it's encased in an exoskeleton made of ribs, teeth, and God only knows what.
Yeah, this is normal now.
Yeah.
After that, oh, it's coming. The moment that continues to divide the internet. The punchline of 2012. This whole minute, well, most of this minute, other than the sphincter hole stuff, is spent assuring the audiences that the environment is indeed safe to breathe, that the atmosphere is remarkably Earth-like. Did it ever strike you when you first watched it as, not a good idea?
I mean, it's hard, because I'm coming to it as a viewer who has seen Alien films and sort of action horror films before. So you never, it's like, you don't touch the relic, you don't take your helmet off, you don't split up from the team. There are all these tropes.
Yeah.
But if I were to put myself into the shoes of an explorer on an alien world, it is interesting that Holloway is the first one to take off his helmet as the kind of, you know, token psychopath of the team, or risk taker, shall we say.
Yes.
Because, yeah, and Shaw expresses my view quite well, which is, what the hell are you doing? So as much as you're right, the film does take its time to set up the rules and say, hey guys, it's fine, they're taking their helmets off, it's definitely okay. I'm very much in Shaw's shoes at that moment where I'm still going like, no, you don't. Why are you taking the helmet off, you crazy bastard?
I guess that's the thing, is you've got the tropes from this genre, from the horror genre, working against this moment. I guess the script writers, no matter what, you would have had this uphill battle of going, no guys, for real, it's gonna be fine. This is not the biggest problem. Which I'll go into it more in the next minute, but yeah, I think you do make a good point that we're already on edge. It's very hard to convince an audience that this isn't the thing you're focusing on. What you should be focusing on is, how do those pups work? And that's the real question.
Look at the shiny things with the lasers coming out of them. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, humidity.
Yeah, look at the CO2 levels. Outside, it's completely toxic. And in here, there's nothing. It's breathable.
What are you doing? Charlie, don't be an idiot.
Hey, don't be a skeptic.
What I notice in that particular moment, though, is that she says it before he actually makes any attempt to do anything. It's just that a little bit too early. What I noticed as well is that there's a little beeping noise. You know, he's playing around with the controls on his wrist. I have to wonder, was that done in post-production? Well, obviously, the sound editing's done in post-production, but if they decided last minute to add that beep. Because if you look at that moment, you go, she doesn't know what he's going to do. There's nothing to indicate that he's going to do anything of the sort. Or just Shaw knows Holloway that well, and if he can think of something stupid, he's probably thinking of actually doing it.
That seems more likely to me. Like, the guy who, you know, at the party sees the can of deodorant and the candle, and everyone knows what's happening 10 minutes before it happens. I think Holloway's that guy.
Yes, he is. My God, you're right.
The guy who sees the, you know, barbed wire fence at the party after a couple of beers, and everyone knows he's going to try and jump it at some point, despite there being no payoff.
He's the biggest frat boy in the academic circle. I don't think he fits in with everybody else.
No, but he's a good character at the end of the day, as much as I wouldn't want him as, like, a road trip companion.
I don't know. I think he'd be quite fun, to be honest. A lot of people hate on Holloway, but through this experience, I've come to like him a bit more. He's a fun guy.
Okay.
He's a bit of a jerk, especially if you're an android, so, oh, shit. No, we wouldn't get along well then. Didn't think this through.
You would for a while, and then suddenly it wouldn't be a problem anymore.
Where'd Holloway go? I don't know. That's a mystery. So this minute ends with him saying, don't be a skeptic, too sure, which I think, bit of a cheeky bugger, because the whole thing of her is, you know, it's what I choose to believe, going with whatever her heart tells her to go with. So I do find it funny that she's kind of the sensible, cautious one instead of racing into adventure, which she was in the first place.
Yeah, it's interesting. It shows how well they... potentially how well they know one another, that he knows that one little comment will get under her skin to the point where he can do whatever he wants, and she now is completely disarmed.
That's a good point. And in the next minute, spoilers, she will remove her helmet. So I guess, yeah, he's got some strategy here. He knows exactly how to talk to her to get through to her.
You've ruined the film. You realize that. For anyone who, this is their first introduction to Prometheus, they've decided to listen to the minute-by-minute podcast format first before seeing the film. They're saving that as a little dessert at the end of watching the actual movie. It's all over now.
Do you think anyone's ever actually listened to a minute-by-minute podcast and then watched the movie afterwards?
I hope so.
What a psychopath. Like, that is some serial killer shit, isn't it?
I think you just put off at least one person in your audience.
I don't give a shit. What is wrong with you, one person in my audience? Watch the fucking movie first.
I don't want to take over your thing, but if anyone is doing that, you should probably ask them to, like, comment or something, just so we know that there's one person out there listening to the minute-by-minute.
Yeah, please comment. Let me know if there is someone so dedicated to me rather than the movie that you just want to hear my voice rather than know anything about the film.
And then please turn yourself into the police.
Yeah, don't talk to me ever again. I do a script segment every once in a while, which first act, both Jonathan Spates and Damon Lindelof, very different ways of getting to the planet and getting into the adventure. But once we get to this point in the film and they enter the cave or temple, it's kind of the same, but there are a few moments here and there that I will read because I think they're kind of interesting. In Spates' script, David sees things that the others can't. In the film so far, this may still be at play because, as I pointed out to you, the way he looks at his surroundings reads to me as if he's reacting to something we can't see, which, to be fair, just looks like he's tripping balls. He's just like, whoa, are you guys seeing this shit?
It's true. Everyone else is looking where they're going and he's like a kid in a candy store. He's just looking around at everything. Something's going on.
So, interior, pyramid, massive chamber. Holloway leads the explorers deeper into the complex. The motors of the cargo rovers whine and growl. Yeah, they aren't walking on foot. They've decided to bring all the vehicles in. Even though, I should note in this script, the door is still broken. So I don't know how they did that. Continuing on. David trails the others, eyes raking the blank walls as if he sees something there. He reaches out, passes his hand through the air as if grasping a cobweb. A strange rumbling noise sounds down the corridor, freezing them. Holloway sweeps his light that way. The sound comes again, a demonic voice speaking some unearthly language, which, of course, is the hologram of the engineers. They talk a lot more in the original version, early scripts as well. And earlier, as they head to the temple, Holloway drives the first rover with Watts, which is Shaw, Beside him, Stilwell, Kamarov, and Downs in back. David drives a second rover with Milburn. Fifield, Chance, and Ravel on board. Watt says, the air here will kill you, so keep an eye on your supply and watch your seals. Pathogen tests are clean. Holloway says, move slowly, stay together, don't touch anything. Things are more fragile than they look, or more dangerous. There might be technologies operating here we don't understand. The crew of the Magellan exchange uneasy looks, still uncertain of what to think. I will give the space script some points there where people are being cautious. They are establishing that the pathogen tests are clean, but keep your helmets on, so on and so forth. So
I think you're right. If they'd approached it like that in the film, where they'd kind of given you breadcrumbs once every so often for the few minutes leading up, rather than just cramming that whole exchange of, is it okay to take the helms off? Yeah, probably. And then it's like 30 seconds. That's a bit jarring.
That's another good point. That's script writing 101, where you sort of, you want to tease out that information of, this is the rules, this is the system, this is how it works, so that when you're crossing the streams in the third act, people aren't like, I didn't know proton packs could do that.
Yeah. Whereas at this point, it kind of just seems like, Holloway he's seen a beer that he wants to drink and then crush against his forehead, so he's just ripped his helmet off and thrown it down the hallway or something.
Exactly.
It's a bit jarring.
So around this time, this is what Vickers was meant to be up to. Vickers suite. Vickers strides through her quarters. On the far wall, there are two small doors. She opens the first, steps into a luxurious bathroom, washes a pill down with a tumbler of water, returns to her cabin and opens the second small door. Secret room, continuous. A chamber walled with steel panels, a deep hum of ventilation and power. There's a lot of technology here. I mean, the whole ship is full of technology, but okay. She turns to a console beside the door, flips a row of switches, the hum deepens. Hidden mechanisms stir to life. So, what could that be about? Even though I've probably mentioned it in the first few episodes, but let's pretend it's a secret.
I've forgotten, so I'm riveted right now.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't know what's about to happen.
Yeah, there's a secret room. I don't... What's in it? Who can say?
I don't know, but I'm keen to find out.
Okay. It won't be for many minutes, so you'll just have to listen to every single one until we get to that. But
I'm okay with that.
Okay. Also in the space script, Fifield is a prospector and Milburn is a geologist. Milburn operates the pups, but doesn't seem to have much of a connection to them. Also, it's Holloway who suggests he use them, making them undoubtedly standard tech in this world rather than some weird prototype that may have been made by Fifield. That's my theory. In the Lindelof script, Milburn is the geologist and Fifield is the botanist, so curiously, the pups disappear in this draft despite coming after the Spates one, so the technology was there in the first draft, they remove it in the second, then put it back in the third, so I find this sort of thing quite interesting. So that about wraps up this minute. Thank you for being my guest, Dean.
You're welcome.
Are you able to come on for another minute?
I'm sure we can arrange that at some point.
Okay.
Thank you for having me on.
That about covers it. This is Coulson, signing off. You can find me on TravianDesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by a Minute on Facebook. Is there anywhere you want to direct people, Dean?
No, I'll just appear here whenever I find it convenient, and that's the only way people can access me. I'm very niche like that.
Yeah, all right.